Come on, Annie. Let's go to the movies.
This is The Cinerealist, episode 610. My name is Kyle.
My name is James.
And my name is Zach.
And we're here to talk movies, movie lists, and movie obsession for the next hour or so. Happy Thanksgiving, guys.
Thanks.
Man.
Yeah.
You're a couple days late, but I appreciate it.
Well, I mean, I maybe wished it to you on the actual day, but, you know, in podcast world, it's Happy Thanksgiving.
Sure. Yes. Not to be that guy again, but what do you guys, how do you guys feel about people on Facebook wishing you a happy Thanksgiving?
No one does that.
Is there anything more pointless?
I've never had that happen.
Really? Yeah. It's not as bad as the birthday thing, but,
you don't like the birthday thing?
No, we've talked about this.
What's wrong with the birthday thing?
There's nothing wrong with it. It's just pointless.
It's rather impersonal. It used to be cool. Like, at first, it was novel. Like, oh, it's on Facebook. I wish you happy birthday. And I was excited about it. And now, I don't know, 15 years into Facebook or whatever, I'm like, nah, you can just send me a text message if you really care.
It's literally, like, short of not doing anything, it's the bare minimum. It's literally, like, you happen to see... It's not like somebody went to my profile and then wished me a happy birthday. They just happened to be a Facebook addict, saw that it was my birthday that day, and clicked like or whatever. Come on.
Facebook prompts you now. It's like, oh, it's James's birthday. Do you want to wish happy birthday?
Right.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's...
There's no point.
Tell me what you think of this. I have a friend. It's definitely not me, okay?
Sure it is.
So don't think it is, but I'll keep this friend anonymous.
Is it me? That'd be funny.
it might be Kyle. And he wrote like a script that sends out a personalized email, but it's like mail merge. So like it'll fill in their name on their birthday and it'll give like a random string of five different like welcomes and then five different body texts that are like happy birthday. And so they'll get an email on their birthday without friend doing anything.
It's at least novel. And at one point he made effort to like create this system. So I'll give him that much. If I knew that I was getting this email from him and I knew how he generated it, it wouldn't be worth much to me after a few years. But most of the people that get it, I assume, don't know those things. And so in that case, why not make them feel a little good about themselves?
I think I would like that better if it showed a skeleton, where if I got an email that said like, dear, insert name, happy, then much like check boxes that they check.
I
like,
send I think that'd be that funnier. Email to them every year on their birthday. And I always think it's funny.
It's like, about as personal
of the system. Yeah.
It's about as personal as clicking like on Facebook, to be honest. Like a dear untitled email or insert name here. First name, last name here.
Yeah.
What's up, guys?
Well, James, I'll say happy Thanksgiving to you in person over Zoom. It's not quite the same, but...
Thanks. Do you guys cook for Thanksgiving?
Do I personally cook or do people in my household cook?
Do you personally cook? Did you cook anything?
I do not cook for Thanksgiving, no.
You never have or you just didn't this year?
I don't think I ever... I mean, I've cooked a turkey before. When we've hosted, I've done turkey before.
All right.
Yeah.
King Kyle over there just getting everybody to cook for him, I guess. What about you, Zach?
I certainly have before. I enjoy the process. I'm trying to think this year if I cooked anything.
Oh,
I definitely participated in the deviled eggs.
Yes. Okay.
Does that mean you ate them?
Well, that too, but I helped make them.
Okay.
I helped make the mashed potatoes this year.
All right.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
But we also, we ate it at another person's house. So like we didn't host.
Oh, okay.
Right. Fair enough. We ate at my parents' house. Like when we're hosting, we, as in mostly Megan, will do most of the cooking.
Sure.
But nice. She also really enjoys it being a chef and all. So. All
right. Good excuse. I agree. I made green bean casserole for my family.
Is this like the casserole with the Campbell's soup and all that stuff?
Yes, it had Campbell's soup.
All right, the classic, yeah.
It had fresh green beans. I think next year I want to actually make the soup and actually fry the onions.
oh, so you're going to move away from the cans. Instead of using like frozen green beans, you're going to go fresh green beans, make the soup yourself.
I've already got the fresh green beans covered. I did that this year.
Okay.
Next year, I want to go completely non-prepackaged food.
I feel like the fresh green beans is a low-hanging fruit of that meal. It's going to be making the soup yourself will be the
sure.
next step.
I mean, I was dipping my toe, you know, in the ocean yeah, with the fresh green beans.
Green bean casserole is maybe my least favorite traditional Thanksgiving food.
Really? Maybe?
Yeah. Maybe. I don't think I'd like it.
Weird. I love it.
I don't know if I've ever had it. I've had green beans at Thanksgiving, but like never the Campbell's green bean casserole.
It just sounds soupy and green beany.
Yeah. I don't think I've ever had it.
I mean, that's basically what it is.
Yeah.
But it's good.
Oh, yeah. No, I can picture it. I just don't think it's ever been served to me.
All right. Fair enough. Anything else happen over Thanksgiving?
Did you guys, anyone watch any like Thanksgiving movies with family?
Nope.
No.
There's not a lot of Thanksgiving movies, I feel like.
Oh, I should refresh that. I should say movies during the long weekend with family, not Thanksgiving themed.
We watched The Parade.
Oh, okay.
My wife's really into watching The Parade every year, so we watched The Parade.
Nice. Awesome. All right. Well, enough chit-chat, guys. It's time to get down to business. We're going to talk Napoleon this week, at least two-thirds of us are. And then we're going to go
Napoleon?
Napoleon.
That's not what you guys told me. You didn't tell me we're doing Napoleon.
What did you see, Zach?
How dare you?
You said we're watching that 10-hour docuseries about Napoleon.
Well, oh, yeah.
What?
Oh, April Fools. Got you.
You got me so good. All right. I guess I can't participate.
I would love if Zach watched the 1927 5-hour version. Like, oh.
I have seen that. It's good.
Yeah? Is it worth seeing?
No, it's great, actually, I would say. Yeah.
I want to see it. The 5-hour runtime is just a barrier to entry, but I'll break it up overnight.
It starts like a half an hour snowball fight when he's a kid. It's great.
This was made in the 50s?
20s.
No, 20s. 20s. Silent.
Ugh.
Is it like a biopic where it's like a kid through, is it his whole life? It is. Okay. Okay. Where this Napoleon is a little bit more centered on a specific era.
It's a 5-hour silent film.
Yeah.
Ugh. Can't imagine anything more torturous.
Imagine if it's riveting.
I'm trying to. I just can't.
It's really good. No, it's really good.
I think something that's fascinating about silent film is because they can't use audio to tell a story. Like so often the visuals are so fascinating. Yeah.
It's like vegan food, how like really good vegan food is usually awesome because like they have one hand tied behind their back because they can't use meat. And so they have to like compensate by making it amazing.
I don't think I've ever had enough vegan food in my life to
I don't think
agree
you're really selling
that.
It to James. No, silent films, it's like vegan food, James.
You're going to love it.
You're going to love it.
No, it's like how Daredevil is really good sense of perception.
Because
he's blind.
Because silent movies are missing a couple senses. They have to make up for the rest.
Yeah.
I gotcha. Okay.
All right, so we're going to talk Napoleon, and we're also going to talk the top 10 films of Ridley Scott. Before we jump into all that, though, I need to remind you there's a video version of this podcast. Go check it out there. Search Cinerealist, find us, subscribe, and watch while you listen. You can also support us on Patreon, patreon.com/Cinerealist. Get extra after-show audio, as well as other Cinerealist swag. You could leave us an Apple Podcast review. We'd appreciate that. 5 stars only, or send us an email to heyguys@cinerealist.com with a comment, question, list suggestion, movie suggestion, any of those kinds of things we enjoy getting via email and we'll talk about on an upcoming episode of the podcast. Kyle, are you ready to talk Napoleon?
I'm ready, James.
We are going to leave Zach out of this conversation because he didn't make it to the movie this weekend, which is fine. He had commitments. Let's say that. Commitments? You were committed?
Yeah, I couldn't watch the movie.
He self-committed this weekend, but he's out now and ready to rejoin the world.
Right. But if you're a big Zach fan, he'll be back for our top 10 Ridley Scott list. So just fast forward to that, I guess.
And if you hate Zach, then happy early Christmas.
And with that, we're going to talk Napoleon. It's in theaters now. Here's a clip.
Why are you staring at me?
Am I?
Yes?
I was not.
Oh, you weren't.
I was staring at your face.
What is this costume you have on?
This is my uniform. I led the French victory at Toulon. Do not tell me your name.
That was Napoleon, a movie that's in theaters now and also soon to be on Disney Plus. The rumor is before the end of the year.
Apple, maybe?
Apple Plus.
Okay.
Sorry, yeah. There's too many pluses out there.
I get you.
Why did they decide Plus was going to be the thing for all these streaming services?
I think because it's like a bonus. It's like, oh, you want more Disney? Okay.
It's a bonus you have to pay for?
It is, yes. It's a bonus you have to pay for.
Okay. Well, I don't get it, because it's not like they had an original streaming service and then like this is the better version of that. It's like right out of the gate, Apple and Disney both said, we're starting with a Plus.
Well, I mean, Apple TV Plus makes sense because Apple TV is the product. And then Apple TV Plus is like, here's this add-on service you can use with our product. The Disney Plus thing doesn't quite make as much sense.
I guess. You're winning me over, Kyle. I agree. Apple is absolved. Disney, however,
logic always wins.
Disney is guilty as charged. All right. So Napoleon is a movie with a plot description. That description is an epic that details the checkered rise and fall of French Emperor Napoleon Bonaparte and his relentless journey to power through the prism of his addictive, volatile relationship with his wife, Josephine. This movie stars Ridley Scott. And well,
stars
it,
Ridley Scott?
It was directed by him.
Okay.
He's really
maybe
the star.
Maybe get a cameo
of it,
somewhere. Yeah.
The movie stars Joaquin Phoenix, Vanessa Kirby, Tahar Rahim, amongst many, many others, I would say. Too many to name. There are a lot of actors in this movie, as well as just a lot of, I don't know, cannon fodder in this movie. There's a lot of cannons in this movie.
There's a lot of battle in this movie.
A lot of battle, a lot of people getting hit with cannons. Literally exploding in front of your very eyes. There's a lot of
that. This movie kind of right out the gate lets you know that there's going to be cannon carnage throughout this movie.
Right.
So,
and they did not disappoint with that expectation.
No. This is sure. Like, what's that Brad Pitt tank movie? Fury? This is like Fury for Napoleon.
Sure. I think this was more violent than Fury, but I understand what you're saying.
Maybe.
You haven't seen Fury in a while. There's one or two key moments, but for the most part, it's not that violent, I would say.
Okay. Then this is probably more violent than Fury.
Anyway, Napoleon, we've seen it. Both of us. You want to go first? You want me to?
You know, usually one of us goes first. Let's let you go first today.
Okay.
Yeah, what'd you think, James?
What did I think of Napoleon? It's a good question. Thanks for asking it. It was kind of long.
Okay.
And not as many, as much as we've, hyped up the battles in this movie, there's really not that many of them. There's kind of like three, I would say, main ones. They gloss over some of the other ones, kind of show them in, montage-y, fast, sped up time. As he's doing his various conquests and victories. But for the most part, there's kind of three action sequences. And in between those action sequences, there's a lot of lover's angst between Josephine and Napoleon.
Yeah.
And I liked that movie for the most part, but also kind of felt like I didn't learn anything about Napoleon that I didn't already know. And I have a pretty surface level of Napoleon.
Really? Okay. Sure. So like you knew about him and Josephine?
Yeah, I knew about him and Josephine. I knew about the letters. I knew that, like, that's kind of where he gets the the whole term Napoleon complex.
Right.
It's not entirely derived from these letters, but the letters were extremely embarrassing to him. The fact that they were passed around at the time and have survived throughout history.
Right.
And it's because his legend was that he was this, you know, all conquering battle master. I don't know what you'd call it.
He was a master tactician.
Right. And the letters kind of put into question, I guess, how hard he was or, you know, his manhood. I don't know. So anyway, I understand that that's certainly part of the story. And I feel like that I wasn't upset that that part was told, but it kind of felt like it came in place of more, not necessarily action, but more explanation of just how dominant he was. And I think they did a decent job of like showing some of his opponents go from enemies to, I don't know, allies over the course of the movie.
Right.
Begrudgingly, clearly begrudgingly, they became allies. And so I got the gist, but I'm not looking for a 5-hour black and white movie from the 1920s to explain every single detail of every single battle. But I kind of feel like they breezed by a bunch of pretty important stuff. Again, not knowing the entire Napoleon story and having a cursory knowledge, I felt like they covered what a cursory knowledge would give you in today's society as a person in their mid-40s. And so, as from a story perspective, I wasn't upset with what we got, but it kind of felt like with 2 hours and 40 minutes, there was more to say beyond the Josephine Napoleon story. That being said, the battle sequences in this movie are pretty fantastic. If you like war movies and period set war movies in particular, certainly movies within this time period, just after the French Revolution, I mean, this is from an action choreography execution, perfect practical and digital effects combination. There's not much better, I would say, than what Napoleon does in this movie during those sequences. The ice sequence was amazing.
Frozen lake was great.
Yeah, yeah. It was beautifully shot. I didn't expect that. I wonder if that's historically accurate. Did he actually do that in a battle?
So you know more about Napoleon than I do, because like this was, aside from the fact that he was this conqueror and the Napoleon complex, I knew very little about him besides the hits, right? Okay. The highlights of his career, but definitely nothing about the backstory.
Yeah.
So yeah, I can't tell you what we saw, how much of that was accurate versus how much of that was Ridley Scott taking some artistic license.
Right.
I'm sure he did. Like I did read. In the Battle of Waterloo, in that sequence, Napoleon rides in with his cavalry leading the charge.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And no general was doing that during that era. They all would lead from the back. So that was something that was obviously made up for the film, but you know, visually it looks exciting and for the story to see him at the front of the charge.
Mm-hmm.
So that's an example where Scott took some license. I'm not sure what else he did in this movie.
Yeah. I mean, with the relationship with Josephine, they kind of portray him as kind of like this, you know, spineless wuss, I would say, when it comes to her. And so I think because of the events of the film, at that moment, having him ride, I think, was more a story point.
Right. Yeah.
I don't know if that's historically accurate or not, but I'm assuming
it's not.
It wouldn't be based on what you're saying.
You're right.
I guess my point is that I think his legend is one half of the Josephine and the love letters and the Napoleon complex of it all. And then the other half is that he, on top of all that, he was a skilled tactician, at least at the time.
Mm-hmm.
What was given to him to use in battle, he used intelligently. And there's kind of just one example of that for the most part. At the beginning, there's a little bit, but you know, the scene with the ice is kind of the only scene where you get to see that in action. And so I kind of wish we had seen more of that, like real world examples of him being good at this. Mm-hmm. And so that's my biggest complaint, but it's not that big a complaint. I did enjoy watching this. I enjoyed Vanessa Kirby and her performance as kind of like the woman left behind, and him just needing her approval, I would say.
Yeah.
Like pretty useless without it for the most part. Any time he felt slighted by her, he just absolutely could not function. And I don't know if that's the impression that the letters give off. I haven't actually read them, but that's definitely the impression the movie gave off. And I enjoyed the drama of all that for the most part. I have also heard rumors that there's like a 4-hour cut of this movie. And I'm curious to know how much of what I'm complaining about that's missing from the film is in that 4-hour cut.
I mean, I would be. Yeah. So Scott has said he's, when this gets in Apple TV Plus Max excellence, mm-hmm. whatever release, it's going to be it's going to be another 2 hours longer.
Oh, over 4 hours.
Yeah. I thought 4.5 is what I read.
Wow.
I'd be curious to know. Yeah. Like was there a major battle that was filmed, which they just cut from this whole movie,
mm-hmm.
or is it going to be a lot more of the Josephine and also sort of the political plotting? Because I think that's the third part about this movie,
mm-hmm.
is there's a lot of plotting between, I mean, this is a very tumultuous time in French history where it was post-revolution. The guillotine was taken off. There's people pushing back against that.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of changes in leadership of who's king, who should be running the country. And this movie definitely shows a lot of that backroom plotting, mm-hmm. of, well, we should be in charge, and well, we should be in charge, and like all these both bloody and bloodless coups that were being led. And mm-hmm. I can't imagine living in a country and like every 10 years, there's a new head of state.
Sure.
Like, all right, we're a monarchy now. And okay, no, now we're a constitutionalist. Or, you know, like it's just got to be real whiplash for the common French person after a while. And like, how much, if you're a peasant or not a peasant, if you're, you know, not of the aristocracy,
mm-hmm.
like how much do you care if every 10 years that keeps getting changed like that? Is that having major effect on your life, or is all just miserable the whole time?
I think they were generally miserable and more concerned with like getting a loaf of bread for the week,
right.
than they were anything going on with the monarchy.
Your, exactly.
Your average person in France, yeah. at that time.
Yep.
But certainly the wealthy there cared, who was in power. Certainly.
For sure. Yes.
What'd you think of our good friend Joaquin Phoenix in starring role?
Yeah. So I thought it was interesting that he was not doing an accent.
Mm-hmm.
Like he just was speaking his normal Joaquin Phoenix voice.
Yeah.
And everyone seemed to be speaking in like whatever their native accent was.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was definitely a choice on Scott's part. Like, we're not going to try and do fake French accents. We're not all going to speak like we're British. We're just going to just use your speaking voice.
Mm-hmm.
So that's something that I noticed, but did not bother me. I think Joaquin Phoenix brought some humor to this role, which is something that you did not mention. Like there were several laugh out loud lines for me.
Sure.
And like memorable moments. And I don't know if Napoleon was a witty person or had humor about him, but mm-hmm. just how that was used in this movie, I thought also kind of just showed both his insecurity and his hypocrisy as a person.
Mm-hmm.
Like he has that one great line where he says something like to Vanessa Kirby, like, I'm not built like other men. I'm not the jealous kind. And this is already right. like halfway into the movie. You're like, of course you're the jealous kind.
He's like, already traveled like halfway across the globe because he was entirely jealous.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. So, I mean, it uses that. And there's also just some other lines that just stood out, which I don't want to spoil because they were quite funny.
Mm-hmm.
But not knowing much about Napoleon, as I said before, I liked the Josephine part of this and how so much it seems so much of what he was doing was for her approval. And like at least this movie was positing that like she was one of the driving forces behind the ambition he displayed. Because at some point he even says, again, this could be part of the hypocrisy. Like he says, I'm not an ambitious man at mm-hmm. some point, even though he's slowly rising through the ranks of power. Mm-hmm. The battles you mentioned, they were great. Mm-hmm. They were great. I could have used more of those because Ridley Scott knows how to film a battle. And he's done this in other movies before, and which I'm sure we'll talk about later in the podcast. Mm-hmm. He knows what he's doing, and he knows how to use CG so effectively, where like there's moments where you've got hundreds, if not thousands, of infantrymen and horses riding across a field. And it's probably CG, like it has to be CG, but it's filmed so well and seamlessly that I'm not watching this. I don't think I'm watching a bunch of CG horses running across a foggy field.
Does it have to be CG? I mean, this was an expensive movie to make.
I mean, it doesn't. It's okay. It's most likely CG.
I think it's CG enhanced, but I think they actually put guys on horses and ran them down a hill.
So that's what I'm saying is like he might have taken 100 actors and horses, ran them down a hill, and then filled in another 800 around it.
Right.
But he uses it so effectively.
It's hard to tell.
Exactly. And yeah. I think that's one thing that Ridley Scott has shown in the last 20 years is how he can use CG effectively to enhance what he's doing, but still also give you something visceral and real to look at.
Yeah. The estimated budget, according to Wikipedia, and this is a pretty wide range, somewhere between $130 million and $200 million.
Yeah.
It's like $70 million in the middle there.
Yeah. Like I've heard more on the higher end for that range. Mm-hmm. So,
but the box office after opening weekend, almost $80 million, which for a historical epic is a good haul, I would say.
That's not bad.
Yeah.
Yeah, better than I thought it would be.
For sure.
There, I will say, like, so you're right. This movie does gloss over some things, mm-hmm. which, again, I was fine with because I wasn't looking for, like, a beat-by-beat historical biography of Napoleon. Mm-hmm. I think some of the worst biopics try and give you everything, and then they feel like a montage where it was, like, doing the hits. Mm-hmm. And even though this movie does focus on his probably most famous period from like when he was starting to become a general to exile, it still felt like it was, I mean, this is a phrase you've been using a lot recently. You can disagree with me. It feels like a vibe movie at times mm-hmm. where like we're kind of checking in on something, but we're not going to give you like the nitty gritty of what's happening, nor are we going to spend minutes like trying to discuss some political machination that's happening. And actually, I kind of liked that. I think that kept this movie moving forward, even though it is over 2.5 hours long, that it didn't seem to bog down in some of these details. And it kind of knew, let's give us a battle and let's give you like some Josephine stuff and some political stuff, but we're not going to get mired too much in any of it.
Yeah. I mean, I think
that worked for me.
I'm willing to bet that Ridley Scott made a Ridley Scott movie that like was fairly complete, and then in the edit he like turned it into a Sofia Coppola movie when it comes right, to the plot, you know what I mean? He's like, we'll just cut every plot element that's specific and only leave the vibes, basically, except for a few of the hits.
Right. So you agree this did kind of feel like a Sofia Coppola movie in that sense?
Yeah, I mean there's a couple of specific points in his life that are covered. Now often they're referred to. You're not actually shown those things happen, right, but they're referred to. And sometimes they're, you know, minutes after type of thing. It's not a whole lot of showing. A lot of talking about things that happened or are going to happen type of thing. And that's fine. I didn't necessarily have an issue with those things. I guess I wasn't ready for it to be so long and also such a relationship movie.
Yeah.
I figured there'd be a decent amount of relationship, certainly. Like Vanessa Kirby got pretty big billing in the trailer, stuff like that. They clearly wanted like a younger person who is a rising star compared to like Josephine's like 6 years older than Napoleon in real life.
Yes. Yeah.
And so why they cast like a a lead actress that's like 20 years younger than Joaquin Phoenix. There's reasons, obviously. And so I understand why all that's in there. I don't necessarily have a problem with it. I just feel like there's a lot left to say about this character. And I'm not sure there was enough said about him to fully represent what I have thought he was about. Like I felt like they fully represented how he was a loser in love. I feel right, like that's fully represented in this movie. The idea that he's a skilled tactician instead of a battlefield troll, I would say. I'm not sure you get that from this movie. You kind of feel like he got lucky that one or two times.
I disagree. So you have that first battle. It's like the Battle of Toulon or something. The kind of where he made his name. He got a promotion.
Sure.
And like he obviously has this whole plan of how they're going to attack this fort and why this fort's important and the cannons and everything. So like you see there that he seems to be like a decent tactician because his plan seems legit. He's not just, let's just run at the walls and see what happens. Right. And then Phoenix gives this little nervousness to Napoleon for that first battle, which I thought was really interesting because he wasn't showing quite the confidence that we do see in later Napoleon battles, where, you know, he does seem a little nervous. He's kind of frightened by the cannon fire and he's definitely not sure if this is going to work out or not, even though to him, it seems like a great plan. He doesn't know, will this work? Later in the movie, he comes up with this plan and he's pretty confident it'll work. Mm-hmm. And spoiler alert, we get to the Battle of Waterloo where he's as confident as ever.
Yeah. It's interesting how you can kind of track how confident he is over the course of the movie based on how he reacts to cannon fire.
Yes. Yeah.
It's kind of wild. I liked in that first sequence after they've won the battle, spoiler alert. And, he's kind of like walking through the soldiers to his dead horse. And he's got that like half goofball smile on his face. Like,
yeah,
he knows he shouldn't smile, but he's very proud of himself.
Right.
In that moment.
Yeah.
It was a good touch for sure.
What I think what this movie was maybe missing for me, because there's implications to it. Again, I don't know the Napoleon history, so this could be just me reading between the lines. Mm-hmm. But it seems like a lot of what he was doing and what his brother were doing, at least in the early years, was based on maybe the approval or the pushing of their mother. Because like at one point he's talking to his brother and he says something like, oh, and we'll do just as mother said we will, or as mother planned or something. Mm-hmm. So I was wondering if there is some sort of connection between him trying to get approval from his mother and then him trying to get approval from Josephine. And I was hoping the movie would go there. Mm-hmm. You know, like maybe there's like a little bit of an Oedipal complex going on. Maybe not Oedipal is the right word, but you
sure.
know, like the you know, we need mother's approval, and then that's being now magnified through Josephine, but it never quite goes there. And the mom does show up, but she's not quite as big of a role as I thought she would be, as they talked about her in the first half hour of the movie.
Yeah, I mean, I'm willing to bet, and I'm down to watch the long version for sure, but
right.
I'm willing to bet there's probably more of that in there. There's probably more of the politicians that come in and out of his life, and like the political game that's happening over like who's going to be emperor or who's going to be in charge of, what do they call it in France? The Congress? There's actually a name for it.
I think they have a parliament.
Yeah. Something like that. I don't remember. Who's in charge of that? You know, like there's a lot of spinning wheels in this movie, and they just kind of are like, oh, by the way, we did that thing like a year ago and now we're onto this new thing. And you're like, okay, I'm sure there was a story behind that, but we just skipped right by it. And now we're moping around with Josephine again.
But I mean, to defend this movie, though, this movie has made the decision that this is about his relationship with Josephine.
Sure.
It's not trying to give you a complete beat by beat, because either A, that's going to be a 5-hour movie, which we're going to get probably anyway, or is this going to be like The Iron Lady, where you feel like it's going to be like every 2 minutes is a new era and something new happens, and you're just kind of, it's whiplashy at least. So
sure.
I appreciate that this movie whether you liked it or not, at least chose a story. And like, we're going to focus on a couple of the great battles, but we're really going to focus on how he and Josephine affected him as a person.
But did it though? I mean, like, compare this to Priscilla, right? That's a movie that is a story inside a much bigger story. Does it ever go on stage with Elvis? Does it go on tour with Elvis? Does it leave the main character, the main plot line of Priscilla kind of being a, you know, left at home wife and being lonely and not even knowing what her husband's doing? You know, like, Sofia Coppola committed to telling that story. Whereas this movie commits to the Josephine Napoleon arc for sure, but throws in all this other super enticing stuff. Right? But only gives us like shades of that when it gave us a full picture of the Josephine Napoleon stuff. Again, I didn't dislike what I saw, but it definitely felt like there were threads left open that I would have liked to have seen explored. Maybe it just wouldn't fit in this cut of the movie. Maybe it'll play better on an extended or director's cut. We'll see.
Right. Yeah. I agree. There's definitely more to this story, but I like the story that we got.
I kind of wish this was like an 8-hour miniseries. That would be great. There's plenty to fill 8 hours, I'm sure. Whether they could have done it in that budget, probably not on an 8-hour thing.
You never know.
All right. Anything else with Ridley Scott's Napoleon before we give it a Letterboxd score?
I just want to mention the music. It seemed like it was period specific music, but for some reason I felt like the movie could have broken out into like punk rock at any moment. Like, they could have dropped in a late 70s punk rock song and it would have fit this movie. I don't know why.
I wonder if I didn't really note the music, but I'm wondering if, you know, it was certainly symphonic from my memory, but maybe they had like punk backbeats over the course of the film, and that's what was giving you that taste.
It might have been. Yeah, it might have been like symphonic music with like a beat. I don't know. I need to hear it again, but it just felt a little discordant to me.
Okay.
I don't know. What's the word when something doesn't line up with the era that it's set for? I can't think of that word right now.
Off topic?
I don't know. I'll think of it halfway through the podcast. There's a specific word when it's... anyway, so I liked it, though.
All right. I enjoyed it as well. I mean, I enjoyed the presentation in general. It very much reminds me that we don't get big, epic, historical movies anymore.
No, we don't.
And I miss these. I'm kind of glad we don't constantly get them for sure. But, and I'm glad that Ridley Scott is the one that is the guy that directed this, because he definitely knows how to make them for sure.
Yeah. No, it's, I mean, how old is Ridley Scott? He's got to be,
he's in his 80s, I think.
Okay.
I read a tweet that was like something like Ridley Scott directed 15 movies in his first 40 years of directing, and then 12 in the last 10 or something like
that.
Wow. Like, he is just churning them out. Like, he knows the day is coming. He can no longer do this. And so he's just pounding them. That's not exactly what the tweet was, but that was the gist of it without the details being correct. But yeah, he's definitely working hard right now compared to, I believe it, like after Gladiator, he didn't make another movie for 5 or 6 years. And now he's making one a year, it feels like.
Yeah, because he did the last Duel,
House,
2021.
House of Gucci. Right before that. Yep. There's a bunch. We're going to go over them here in a few minutes.
Perfect. But. Yep. Yep.
All right. Let's letterbox this. I will give Napoleon a 4.
I will also give it a 4.
Nice. I think it could have been a 4.5 or a 5 had my concerns been addressed. And maybe they will be with a director's cut. We'll see. All right, let's jump into our top 10 films of Ridley Scott. But before we do, Kyle has a very important question for Zach.
Zach, I can't think of this word. It came up in our previous discussion.
Sure.
What's the word for like when you're watching a movie that takes place during a certain era and then they play modern music?
Anachronistic.
Anachronistic. Thank you. That was killing me.
Spoiler alert. They do that through the entirety of Napoleon, Zach. You're going to hate it.
They don't.
Like Marie Antoinette.
Yeah, right. Yes, that's the example. Life branch, anachronistic. Ah, I cannot think of that word. James is no help whatsoever.
I said diegetic. That's pretty close.
No. I mean, that's not at all.
Close at all.
They both end in it.
And most likely it would be non-diegetic if that's what the case is.
That would be hilarious. I've never seen Marie Antoinette, but you're watching Marie Antoinette, like some punk rock song's playing, and then she like picks up the stylus on the gramophone and it stops playing.
That would be awesome.
That would be diegetic right there.
That'd be the best.
Yeah.
What's the movie with Heath Ledger where he's at night?
A Knight's Tale.
Yeah, and they play We Will Rock You.
Yeah.
And like everyone in the crowd is like stomping along.
Right, yeah.
I love it in that movie. I mean, it's perfectly placed, in my opinion, in that movie.
Love it?
It's great. I mean, come on. They're making it, it's an allegory. They're like, oh, this is the jock jams. Works in any period. We Will Rock You, stuff like that.
Yeah, next the horses dance to I Like to Move and Move It. And it's just
you guys don't like A Knight's Tale? What's wrong with you? Do you hate life?
I saw A Knight's Tale when it came out. I've got no memory besides the We Will Rock You part.
Well, you need to rewatch it then.
You have no idea what I think of Knight's Tale.
I need to rewatch
you have
no
it. No clue.
I think you like it, Zach.
You don't know. That's the thing. You don't know.
Well, tell me.
Yeah, I liked it.
Okay. There we go.
I love it.
How dare you?
Not like you.
I didn't say I love it. I said I liked it.
You said you loved it.
I don't think I said I loved it.
Oh.
If I did, I take it back.
Rewind the tape.
I take it back. It's rewind time. I take it back. I like it. All right. Speaking of movies I like, and you guys probably like as well, let's talk the top 10 films of Ridley Scott. Who wants to go first with their number 10?
I'll go first.
All right.
So I'll start by saying that I've seen 13 Ridley Scott movies,
right,
which, I don't know, it seems kind of a small number considering how many he's actually directed.
Directed like 17?
No. I don't know. We were talking about how he cranked out a bunch in the last 15 years so far.
On Letterboxd, I only see 17. Well, actually, those are only ones I've seen. Never mind.
Oh, okay.
He definitely has more than that.
Never mind.
I've seen 13. I wanted to watch Kingdom of Heaven for this episode. I just did not get to the time to do so. So that will not be on my list. But my number 10 is Hannibal from 2001. This is the sequel to The Silence of the Lambs. Stars Anthony Hopkins as Hannibal, where he's the main focus now of the story. And instead of having Jodie Foster come back, you have Julianne Moore, who I can't remember if she's actually playing Clarice Starling or if she's playing a different detective, FBI agent. Do you guys remember?
No.
I do not remember. I can probably find out if I click on the poster. But anyway, so this is a sequel to Silence of the Lambs. It's based on the book of the same name. It's a little pulpier than Silence of the Lambs. It's more focused on, you know, Hannibal Lecter and kind of who he is. There's also a whole story with Gary Oldman and his pigs. But I remember liking this movie when it came out for its era. And it's I don't think it's necessarily like a standout Ridley Scott movie, but for being number 10 out of 13, I like it.
Nice. Very nice. James?
My number 10 is All the Money in the World from 2017. This is the drama that he directed about the kid who gets kidnapped and then his mother who married into the family, and her husband, who's the son by blood, passed away. I don't remember if she's a widow. There's some kind of story complication like that. So her son gets kidnapped and then there's a ransom, and her father-in-law, who's incredibly wealthy, could easily pay the ransom and get the son back, and he refuses to pay. And she doesn't like that. And rightfully so, because she wants her son back. And so it's kind of a thriller of sorts, a drama. The movie's probably more famous for being the movie that Kevin Spacey was replaced out of. I think it was... Who was it? Christopher Plummer replaced him when he got in trouble for his horrible, horrible actions. One of the things that was a repercussion is they literally, a movie that was already shot with him in it and a trailer released, they pulled him digitally out of the movie and replaced him with Christopher Plummer, which was kind of awesome. Like, if you watch the movie, you'd never guess. It's really good editing and picking your spots to actually do it digitally and just kind of shooting around everything else. Really well done. And a tight little thriller. My number 10.
Cool. Well, my number 10 is the director's cut of Kingdom of Heaven. One thing that when I think of Ridley Scott, I think of director's cuts. Like, I can't think of another director that is more known for re-editing his films, and that they often get better in the re-edit. Kingdom of Heaven is a great example of this. I think the movie absolutely improves in the director's cut. This is the story of the Crusades, told in his kind of like gladiator style. And it's pretty epic and visually stunning and fun to watch. It's got Legolas in it, which is fun. And I liked it, but I was pretty underwhelmed with the theatrical cut. And then I gave it another chance with the director's cut, and I liked it quite a bit more. The pacing was better. The ending made more sense. It felt like we got more details of the time. It was cool.
So I should watch the director's cut over the theatrical release?
I definitely, possible? Definitely okay. Think so. Yeah.
Cool. All right. Good. See, now I'm glad I didn't watch it for the podcast. I would have watched the wrong one.
You would have. Yeah.
Would have been a big mess. You'd have to watch it twice in 1 week.
That's just, I don't got time for that. But I do have time for my number 9, G.I. Jane, 1997. This is a movie I actually saw with Zach in the theater way back when we were 14 years old. It's one of the first, not the first, one of the first R-rated movies I saw in the theater. And this is a story about a woman played by Demi Moore, who is a trial candidate to be enlisted in the Navy. So, you know, at when this movie was made, women could not serve at least frontline in armed forces. So the plot of this movie is there is, you know, the Navy is going to try allowing women to serve, you know, frontline in the services, go through boot camp. And Demi Moore's character is the first candidate to go through this process. And she is definitely harassed and seems like she's being singled out by her commanders to make her fail because, you know, the politics behind the whole situation. It's a really strong Demi Moore performance. I have not seen this movie since we saw it in the theater, however many years ago that was. But I do remember, like, she stands out as the performance. Viggo Mortensen's in this, speaking of our Lord of the Rings connections to Ridley Scott. I do remember the ending being kind of stupid. I think, like, it's a movie where it gives you three quarters great training montage, you know, all this her going through the training, and then has a kind of dumb ending, but I don't really remember it very well. Maybe Zach, you remember better. It'll be later on your list.
I mostly just remember her shaving her head.
Yeah, that's a big moment. I really remember her ringing the tap out bell and like cracking a baseball bat across it or something like that. That was a big dramatic moment too. So a lot of dramatic moments in G.I. Jane.
Yeah. James?
Oh, sorry. Just distracted by the mental picture of a young Kyle and Zach sitting in a dark theater watching G.I. Jane for some reason. Who took you to that?
No one. We went by ourselves.
Took ourselves.
Yeah.
We watched a lot of movies together.
It's
how old were you guys when you were watching G.I. Jane? Isn't it a rated R movie?
Yeah, we were 14. Yeah,
14.
You snuck into G.I. Jane?
No. You could, when we were under 17, you could go see R-rated movies if you were under 17. Like somewhere in the late 90s, like right around when we turned 17, 18, that's when the theater policy changed of you had to be accompanied by an adult.
Okay. All
right. But yeah. You could go see R-rated movies without an adult back Fair in enough. The day.
My number 9, House of Gucci, 2021. This movie's was generally panned and ignored, I would say, and I enjoyed it. I thought it was super fun, campy, weird. Lady Gaga, Adam Driver, Jared Leto's amazing in this movie. I literally got like three quarters of the way through the movie before I even realized he was in it. His character is like unrecognizable as far as Jared Leto goes. Like I had no clue that was Jared Leto underneath that makeup and in the performance. I was kind of mesmerized by it when I realized that's who I was watching. You know, it tells the story of Gucci and the family name and how it went from a family brand that was based on quality to like kind of a mass market big business, and how most of the members of the family not necessarily got screwed over the course, but the business is much bigger and much more profitable now than it ever was under the family's rule. And it does a good job of telling that story while also being entertaining, in my opinion. And I personally think most traditional name brands, certainly Gucci, when I see people wear that stuff, it looks kind of gaudy to me. And the movie feels gaudy. And that's kind of an accomplishment, in my opinion. I think that vibe, for lack of a better term, put some people off to the movie, but I think it was pretty intentional and pretty successful. My number 9.
I feel like I could make a gaudy movie.
You think you can intentionally make a gaudy movie?
I think that I could.
Okay. I challenge you.
You challenge me?
Sure. Why not?
All right. Challenge accepted, James. All right. My number 9 is Robin Hood. Ridley Scott's Robin Hood. And I would have to say, in general, I was fairly disappointed with this film. I still, on the whole, like it because it is a Robin Hood film, and that just gives it so many bonus points.
Just the fact that Robin Hood is in it.
No, but it has some of those Robin Hood elements that I like seeing on screen. You know what I mean? So, like, you get Friar Tuck, and you get Little John, and you get, you know.
So everybody but Robin Hood is why.
Well, he's in it.
I know, but you're mentioning all the other characters is the reason why.
Well, you asked me, is it just because Robin Hood's in it?
Right. It's not. It's because it's Friar Tuck's in it.
Well, yeah, because
I think it's because it's the Robin Hood world.
Ness, mythos. It's the 12th century. Yeah, you know, sure. It's the blah, blah, blah.
I hear you.
I enjoy seeing that stuff. However, I was fairly disappointed with this film for a couple of reasons, mainly because it feels like a prequel. Like at the end of the movie, he becomes Robin Hood. And at the end of the movie, he goes to Sherwood Forest and becomes like an outlaw. Mm-hmm. And it's just, I would love to see Russell Crowe as Robin Hood in the movie that takes place immediately after this movie. Do you know what I mean? So this whole movie was a setup for a different movie that I would much rather watch. The other thing is like, the big climax of the movie is this full-on battle, like on the beach, between like Robin and his army and the king and his army. And it's just, when I think of Robin Hood, I don't think of like battles in the same sense of like, you know, like gladiator or warfare kind of a thing.
Right. He wasn't like a military leader.
Right. I mean, some stories he fought in the Crusades alongside Richard, but like he's in this movie, he's a general commanding his little army on the beach. And it's not the vibe at all that I think of when I think of Robin Hood. But I do love that time period so much. And so getting to see people in the outfits and the villages and all those trappings, I think is fun for me in a movie. So ultimately I'm fine. I'm glad that it exists, but I would much, much rather watch the movie that starts immediately after this movie. So anyway, that's why it's been number 9.
Is there a director's cut of this one?
Probably.
Okay. But you have not seen it.
I have not seen it.
Okay. My number 8 is American Gangster from 2007. This movie stars Denzel Washington. It's based on a true story, at least partly, about a man who becomes a heroin dealer or a drug kingpin in Harlem. I think it takes place in like the early 90s. I'm not exactly sure when. It's not a movie I don't remember a ton about. I do remember there being a very strong Denzel Washington performance in this movie. And you also have Russell Crowe, who's playing the cop who's investigating. He knows what's going on, but he just can't quite pin Denzel Washington as the kingpin of this empire. But definitely Denzel Washington is the reason to watch American Gangster.
I agree. He's the reason. My number eight is Napoleon, which we just talked about.
Okay.
I don't want to give you any spoilers. So,
in that case,
the Metallica song in it was amazing.
Is Thelma and Louise.
For whom the bell tolls, tolls for thee, Napoleon.
Thelma and Louise.
Okay. Yes.
I came to this movie late, but I enjoyed it. It's, you know, it's two women on a run. It's a, you know, feminist empowerment film. It's got Brad Pitt, a young Brad Pitt. It's got a very iconic ending. The car. Yeah, I was glad I saw this movie. I've only seen it once. I should see it again because I don't remember it a ton, but I did enjoy it.
Nice. My number seven is 2001's Black Hawk Down. Now, this is a movie I've kind of had a roller coaster relationship with over the last 20 years because when it came out, I was in college or just getting into college. It was also right around 9/11. And this movie was, I thought, like one of the greatest movies. It was, you know, it's obviously very pro-American military. It's about the army operation in Mogadishu, Somalia in the early 90s that turned into a rescue mission after a Black Hawk helicopter was shot down. And I remember watching this movie a ton in college and being like, yeah, this is like the greatest military action movie. And then, you know, over time, I thought more about it. I'm like, is this movie really that great, or is it, you know, too patriotic? Is it problematic in its portrayal of like the Somali people? So I watched it, I don't know, about a year ago. I think I got the 4K version of it, and yeah, it can be a little patriotic at times, to a fault. And yeah, the Somali people are definitely portrayed a little bit as caricatures, where that could have been given a more robust characterization of who they were. But it's also a really well directed movie. And it is some great military action. So that's why I got to kind of put it in the middle of my list. Because I do, like, for what it's presenting as like an action movie, I really enjoy. As a historical document, it's probably better to like watch some documentaries or read about things and don't take this as the history of what happened in Mogadishu. But I think as an action movie, it's done very well.
Nice.
My number seven, The Last Duel from 2021. This is a movie starring Ben Affleck and Matt Damon and Jodie Comer and Adam Driver. And it's kind of a movie told in three parts where each part repeats the same storyline from the perspective of one of the three main characters of the film. And I enjoyed it. It's, you know, what would you call this? Set in the medieval times? What period is this?
I mean, we're talking
14th
like,
century?
Yeah, 13th century, 1200s?
Yeah, maybe.
Okay. Yeah. So lots of good battles, lots of sniveling Ben Affleck, which was fun to watch.
1386.
1300s then, right?
So like 100 years after Robin Hood.
No, Robin Hood was
200 years after Robin Hood.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah.
That's how we measure time, before Robin Hood or after Robin Hood.
I mean, that's how I, yeah, everything. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm sure it's going to come up on other lists. And so I'll just say it's great.
You're sure?
I'm sure. I'm positive.
Wow. Okay. Well, my number seven, just like Kyle, is Black Hawk Down. And yeah, I remember seeing this movie in the theater, and then when the credits came on, I like was like stunned, and I like sat in the theater pensive for like 10 minutes thinking it through, because you see like the kids running, you know, like chasing after the vehicles or whatever. Anyway, I was just pensive during it. But the movie was very action packed. All the things Kyle said. I still want to see it on 4K. I still haven't seen it on 4K.
It looks pretty darn good on 4K.
That's what I've heard.
Yeah.
Yeah. Black Hawk Down, number seven.
All right. My number six is the movie of the week, Napoleon. I just can't believe that they had Joaquin Phoenix do the Napoleon Dynamite dance in the middle of the movie.
I know.
Blew me away.
Those Ugg boots are definitely not period specific.
Where did he find Silver Moon boots? I don't know, but pulling them off.
For sure. I agree. My number six also happens to be Black Hawk Down from 2001.
Wow.
Don't have much else to say other than I like this movie a little more than you guys do.
You do. You like it one more than us.
One more. Yep.
That's right. I like Napoleon one more than you do.
Okay. My number six, it might be low for some people. It's Alien.
It's a little low. It's a little low.
It tracks. Low. You don't like horror movies.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't like horror movies. It's good. Don't get me wrong. It's got some memorable stuff. Is that the one with the stomach burster?
Chest burster?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a fun one. It's fine. Yeah, I like
it. It's fine. It's only like a seminal iconic horror masterpiece. It's fine.
Yeah. 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 It's decent. So it's my number six. Wait till you hear my number five.
I cannot wait. It's gonna be Prometheus. He secretly loves
never,
it.
Never.
My number five is I think we were saying this a lot very soon. We previously mentioned The Last Duel. This is a movie that I did not catch until the very end of 2021, and it ended up being my favorite movie of that year. Like James said, it's got three or four great performances: Driver, Damon, Comer, and Ben Affleck. I really liked how it gave us a Rashomon style story, and then it gives us the titular Last Duel at the end, and it reminded me that Ridley Scott, he can still direct some pretty great action scenes. So overall, a quite impressive feat from him. I'm gonna say right now, like, number five is my line between all the movies before this I liked pretty a lot, and number five above is like, these are great Ridley Scott movies for me.
Nice. My number five is from 1982. Some people might say this is low, but it's Blade Runner, the original, which is a movie I like a lot. So I guess my line is between five and six as well, because Blade Runner is a classic for a reason. I think it holds up pretty well, despite the fact that it kind of, is, I don't know, the punkness of some of the Android characters is a little dated, but because of the rapper, the sci-fi rapper with all the neon drenching visuals and stuff like that, just kind of excuses anything that might date it, because you can kind of just imagine it as a completely different world. And I think it holds up. The best thing about Blade Runner from 1982 is that we got Blade Runner 2049 out of it as well.
That's the best thing about Blade Runner?
That's
the sequel?
That's the best thing about it.
Okay.
Wow. That's interesting, James. All right. My number five is Exodus, Gods and Kings.
Oh, interesting.
Now this is controversial.
Apparently. We watched this for the show.
Yeah.
And I really, really liked it. I thought it was quite
remember
good.
That.
Yeah. This is Christian Bale playing Moses. Opposite Joel Edgerton. It also has Sigourney Weaver in it for you Alien fans. I thought this movie was very, very well done. And I especially liked the way that the plagues, the 10 plagues of Egypt, were depicted. It's kind of like it's a brief like montage almost in the film. And it shows how like one plague like leads to the next. It was really visually very cool. And I had a great time with this movie. I gave it 4.5 stars.
Nice.
Let's all just take a moment and acknowledge that Zach's favorite Ridley Scott Sigourney Weaver collaboration is Exodus, Gods and Kings over Alien.
I'm looking, and that does appear to be accurate. No, I'd have to see who's in this one movie. She might also be in this other movie. But I think we can confidently say that I'm not a film snob.
Okay. Are you saying right. I am? I put Blade Runner at number five, all right?
Wow, you really took that personally, James.
I already put my neck out there.
I'm just saying I'm not a film snob. I am perfectly happy putting Exodus, Gods of Kings above Alien.
Oh, I will confidently say that I probably have the film snobbiest ranking of the three of us, of Ridley Scott.
Let's find out.
Yeah. Well, let's go to my number four. This is a top 300 movie for me. I believe Last Duel is a top 500 or 600 movie, but top 300 movie, The Martian from 2015. Yeah, 2015. So this is the movie about Matt Damon being on a trip to Mars, who gets left behind and then needs to figure out how to get himself home because he was left for dead on Mars and, spoiler alert, is not dead. This is based on a book of the same name. And I think this is one of the better book to movie adaptations I've seen. I've read the book. The book is great. This movie gives me the vibe of the book. It gives like some of the major plot points. It definitely shows like Mark Watney being the same character. It gives you a lot of what's going on Earth at the same time, but doesn't feel like it has to adapt every single thing from the book. Like it does a great job of choosing what's important to tell this story that we can fit into a cohesive movie, and what can we leave on the cutting room floor because it's just redundant for a sense of a movie. It's a great Matt Damon performance, and it's, I mean, beautifully shot. The scenes on Mars look great. If I had one complaint about this movie, it's at the very end when he's doing the rescue and he's all tangled up in the ropes spinning through space. This movie came out a year after Gravity, or 2 years after Gravity, and it just gave me like a real Gravity vibe to it that it felt unnecessary for what was a movie about using science to solve all your problems, and logic came down to like, I'm going to make this brash decision. So that was my one complaint with the movie. But other than that, a near perfect movie for me.
I think science gets you far enough, and then you got to do the Hail Mary.
And that maybe that's the point. Is that right? So you're saying science can get you so far?
No. It's just like science will get you as far as you can go.
Right.
And then you got to go with just the Hail Mary luck.
Yeah. And that's how we get to flat Earth. Science takes you so far. And then the rest, you have to figure out for yourself.
We get to flat Earth by people that take science as far as it can go. No one takes science more seriously than them.
Yeah.
Spoiler alert for The Martian, if you haven't seen it. That wasn't in the book. The ending of The Martian?
No, I thought in the book he like passes out and gets rescued. Like he does have to eject, but I don't think there's this whole like I'm going to be Iron Man and fly through.
Oh, interesting. I'm conflating him now. I thought that he did do that in the book, but
I thought in the book like I thought he passes out because he's essentially in an uncovered rocket in space.
that could be true too.
But I mean, admittedly, it's more exciting to watch him do a gravity dance with Jessica Chastain and like cuts to black and he wakes up on the spaceship. So I understand why they made the choice they made.
Have you read Project Hail Mary?
No, I want to though. I need to get back into reading.
Let's just get back into reading. And yeah. Project Hail Mary is really good. Okay. And they're making that into a movie as well.
So I definitely want to see that before I see the movie. So.
Yes. And it's Ryan Gosling is going to be the lead.
Okay. Steamy.
Probably won't be in this film.
Okay.
I doubt it.
Speaking of steamy, my number four from 2012, it's Prometheus. Way better than Blade Runner.
Okay, ugh. So this is a steaming, hot take. This is sure. a hot take.
This right is not here. A hot take. I've always had this take. I've always had this take. Zach,
I'm just saying it's a culturally hot take.
Yeah, culturally, it's a hot take.
Yeah.
Because this movie is trash.
You're crazy. Lots of people love Prometheus. I'm not the only one. Just because you two don't, it feels like everybody doesn't. But
lots of people believe all sorts of things. It's what do most people think.
The people that don't like it also only don't like it because of one scene where some guy takes the helmet off and for some reason the rest of it's ruined.
Not the one scene.
All those people that don't like it like it for that one thing, James.
Yes. That's the only complaint I ever hear. I walk up to people, I say, what do you think about Prometheus? They say, I love it, or I hated when the guy took his helmet off. Well, those are the two answers I get.
That's an easy thing to point to because there's multiple instances of characters making those dumb decisions. Like they open the door when like one of their true members goes missing and then shows up all deformed on like their front doorstep. I'm like, oh, let's open the door and find out what's going on. Like, there's that.
It's their crew member friend. They're trying to save them.
No, don't argue with the specific point, except that he's giving you other reasons.
Right. It's like, isn't it the medical vessels only work on men for whatever reason?
So well, like, no.
So she has to do an abortion with like stomach surgery.
Right. Yeah.
They're programmed to specific people. That one happened to be programmed to a man. She hasn't been programmed into the machine.
Where was her machine then?
I don't remember.
James, you're arguing.
I don't think she had a machine for one reason or another.
You're arguing the specific instances, but Kyle's larger point is that there's plenty of things wrong with it, and people that don't like it can recognize that. It's just the helmet thing is maybe the most glaring example of which there are many examples.
Okay,
Charlize Theron even that tries example. To outrun a rolling spaceship. Like, just cut left.
Yeah,
zig
cut left.
Or zag.
She does cut left. That's how she avoids it.
No, she gets crushed.
Oh, Charlize Theron. Okay, but what's her name? The other chick.
Now I know why he likes it. He has no idea what happens in the movie.
I do know what happened in the movie. How dare you? I've seen it like four times. I love it.
You don't remember it, hence it's your number four.
It's a visual masterpiece that also happens to be an impeccably designed movie. Maybe not scripted, but impeccably designed.
Designed.
With great performances throughout. Perfect tone for an alien prequel movie. It's a shame that the second one was not as amazing as Prometheus was, but that's where it lies.
Zach, I have a question for you.
Yeah.
Is Covenant better or worse than Prometheus?
He's never seen it.
I haven't seen it.
Okay, because I don't take James's opinion, because he puts Prometheus number
one. I imagine it's better.
Well, if you won't take my opinion, then you'll watch Covenant, because Covenant is not as good as Prometheus. So maybe you'll love it.
I will. I'm intrigued to rewatch Prometheus. I'm not gonna lie.
Oh, I would happily rewatch Prometheus.
Right, just to. I'm just
curious. Just to what? Curiosity. You're gonna hate watch it. You got to go in with a totally different perspective. You got to go into it and think, I'm James. What do I like about this? Not. I'm gonna find the 10 things that I can fight with James about over it.
James, here's what I'm gonna do. I'm gonna get a Prometheus tattoo.
I dare you.
And then I'm going to watch this movie.
I double dare you.
So that I like cognitively need to love it in order to justify the fact that I got a tattoo.
What's a Prometheus tattoo? Like just the word Prometheus?
Yeah.
I would imagine a Prometheus tattoo would have to be poorly done.
How
probably
dare
misspelled.
You? How dare you?
Misspelled Prometheus.
How dare you? There is
relatively.
I'll have you know there are zero misspellings in Prometheus.
Are you confident about that?
No, but.
I'm just saying, I have
faith in Ridley Scott that there's no misspellings.
If you get the tattoo and then end up hating the movie again, just tell people you like fire and it's fine.
I'm thankful for fire.
You're thankful for fire.
All right. Well, my number four is the aforementioned The Last Duel. And I liked it for the things that
That's
you liked it for.
Bingo.
Is that the first bingo?
No. The Black Hawk Down. That was our first bingo.
That's a bingo.
All right. Well,
now I got it covered.
You just get that finger ready because
we're gonna have three more bingos.
They're coming hot and furious now. All right. My number three, and now we've jumped into top 100 movies for me, because apparently I have three Ridley Scott top 100 movies. He might be up there with Hitchcock and Kubrick as overrepresented in my top 100, and Spielberg. Gladiator. Number three.
Your number three is Gladiator?
Number three is Gladiator.
Yeah, that's because
it's
number
two is
Alien,
put Prometheus.
And it's number one is Blade Runner. Done.
Well, Zach's... Okay, thanks, Zach. All right, well, thanks for listening to episode 610 of The Cinerealists.
You don't have to confirm yet.
I told you, I'm going to have the snobby list of the videos. So this is my... I think it's my 75th favorite movie, 74th favorite movie of all time. And this is about Russell Crowe, who is a Roman general who gets conscripted into to become a gladiator and goes through that whole process. And it's
a simplification of the story for sure.
Conscripted to be a gladiator.
He's sold as a slave. Okay. Yeah.
Betrayed by the...
Right. But this is, this is an epic, right? Mm-hmm. This is an epic movie of this tale of Russell Crowe as a gladiator. It spans multiple places within the Roman Empire. I believe he's Italian himself, so we even get some like his villa. The action scenes are incredible. The gladiator pits, they're incredibly memorable. there is an actual plot to this movie. It's not just about a gladiator. Like, there is things going on. And it's also a great Joaquin Phoenix performance as Commodus, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's his name.
Yeah.
The Emperor at the time. Probably my favorite Joaquin performance of all time. And definitely the performance that put him on the map for me. So this is a great movie.
Besides Space Camp.
I don't remember him in Space Camp very well.
Oh, really? Okay.
So yeah, not on the map. No.
It's because he's not in the credits. Some guy named Leaf is.
Yeah.
For me, it's Parenthood. You got to watch Parenthood. Then you'll be like, oh, Joaquin Phoenix was good way before.
Oh, I'm sure he was. This is just like my first acknowledgement that he is a unique face as an actor. Yeah.
Fair enough. My number three, The Martian from 2015. I love this movie. It's super fun and interesting and funny. And makes me feel like I know science by watching it, even though I'm sure there's not much science to it. And to go into the ending without spoiling anything, didn't really bother me. Have you guys seen the extended cut of The Martian?
No.
I'd love to. No.
It's good. You guys should watch it.
I have it on 4K. I wonder if the extended cut is on the 4K.
Don't know.
Check it out. I would like to do that. That sounds great. Because my number three is The Martian.
That's a bingo.
I read the book, loved the book, was excited for the movie. Movie came out. It's one of those rare things where the movie had the vibe of the book.
Yes. Yeah.
They had the same tone. It was great. And I love Matt Damon. Matt Damon's great. He's perfect for Watney. And James, the science in the movie was mostly based off the science in the book. And the science in the book was incredibly accurate.
Hmm.
Yeah.
I would say the biggest thing in the movie that was unscientific is that I think the original disaster happened because of a windstorm or something, like a big sandstorm on Mars. And the atmosphere on Mars is so thin that you could not destroy anything with a windstorm.
You can have windstorms on Mars like that.
Yeah. The atmosphere is way too thin. Other than
was the disaster in the book?
Don't remember.
I don't remember either. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's not important.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. But yeah, Martian, really great. I also had no problem with the ending. I was fine with what happened. I liked it. And I love the cast. There's so many people that pop up in this movie. It's like watching It's a Mad, 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 Mad World.
Mm-hmm.
So many people. It's a mad, analogy. Mad, 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 mad world of modern day science fiction.
I'm sure all of two listeners understand your reference.
Wow, you don't give them much credit.
Who has
you don't
seen
think they've
it's
seen
mad,
it's a mad, mad, mad,
mad,
mad,
mad
world.
World? Like, it's just not that's not movie
I've
people
seen it.
Talk about anymore. Really,
James
you've seen
it,
James?
Yeah, I have it on the shelves.
Did Zach make you? Was it did you lose?
No,
a bet?
I've seen it because it's a movie that people see.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I guess I need to see this movie.
Two out
you
of three.
Seen it's a mad, 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 mad world.
No, I have not seen It's a Mad, 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 Mad World. Though I still have it. I completed it. I have the A24 crossword puzzle book.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them is the answer, like the main clue, the main movie of the clue of the puzzle is It's a Mad, 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 Mad World. And there's four rebuses of mad throughout the whole puzzle. I thought that was super clever.
That's great.
Those are the fun crosswords to figure out. Yeah. Okay. Another fun movie to figure out is my number two, which is, I think, my number 50 of all time, Alien, 1979. Incredible horror movie, incredible sci-fi movie. Scott does something great where you don't know who the main character is until like a third of the way through the movie. Where if you watch the movie at the beginning, Sigourney Weaver is kind of a minor character. Like you get the whole crew, but I would not say she's not a leader. She's not in no sense like the main focus of the camera. And then slowly throughout the movie, she becomes the final girl in a sense, right? And she becomes the main character, which is great. Ridley Scott. How he films the actual alien, the xenomorph, is pretty incredible. Because if you ever seen like footage of the thing walking around, it looks like a big tall guy in a rubber suit.
It looks very goofy.
It does look very goofy. And kind of at the very end of the movie, you see the xenomorph in its full form and it looks okay. But for the rest of the movie, he's just filming it, like just the head or a tentacle or a mouth. And you really don't know what you're looking at. And that really adds to the horror of the whole thing. By far, my favorite one is when Dallas is in, he's climbing through the tubes, the tunnels, and mm-hmm. he turns around and the xenomorph is there. And it's just the actor going like putting his hand, like doing jazz hands to scare him. But it's such an effective jump scare, even though if you pause it, it's super cheesy. Mm-hmm. It's, I don't know, it's one of these movies where it's a low budget horror movie and it could have looked super cheesy. But because you had Ridley Scott, who's filming this thing, it became a masterpiece.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
Please.
I don't have a perfect articulation of the difference between one and two, specific scene wise. I understand the differences.
Right.
But like specific scene, I have a scene in my head.
Okay.
And I want to know if it happens in one or two. I believe it happens in two.
Okay.
But my real question is, does it happen in two or does it happen in a parody of two?
What's the scene?
The alien opens his mouth and like another alien head sticks out of the mouth and opens his mouth.
Not
that
it's not another alien head. It's another.
It's a part of his mouth.
It's a part of his mouth that extends out. So I think maybe you're thinking that that's another alien head. But okay. It also might be a parody where they literally had another alien head in some parody movie that I'm not.
Okay. So I think you're thinking of three. Because the most iconic I can think of is where it opened. I believe in all three movies, it opens his mouth and a second mouth comes out.
Mm-hmm. Okay. But Sigourney Weaver is specifically like motionless and it happens right by her ear.
That's three. Because she's bald when it's happening, correct?
I would have bald.
So I think that's the most, for me, that was the most memorable moment of three. And like that's the iconic shot of like she's up against a wall, like her eyes are closed. She's kind of reaching back, but she's pinned to a wall and the alien's mouth opens and that second mouth comes out. So to answer your question, it's not one or two.
Gotcha. Okay, okay. Cool. And then is there a parody where the alien comes out of the alien's mouth and then dances to Hello, My Ragtime Doll?
That's Spaceballs
from Spaceballs.
And that's the chest burster. What's great about that is they get John Hurt, who's an alien who has the chest burster. They bring him in Spaceballs to do the exact same scene.
Mm-hmm. Oh, great. Okay.
And as he's laying there, he says, "Not again," which is so stupid.
They pretty faithfully recreate it right up until that moment, too.
Because it comes out, it dashes across the room, and then it does the "Come on, my baby, come on, my darling."
Yeah. It's pretty wild.
Yeah.
Okay.
My second favorite Ridley Scott movie of all time is, of course, Alien.
That's a bingo.
Which I completely agree with Kyle's assessment of Alien. I don't necessarily disagree with Zach's, but he left a lot of props on the table.
That's what does that
for
mean?
Sure. it's too low for you, Zach. Maybe the one thing that Kyle did not mention that I think is worth mentioning when discussing Alien is just the huevos rancheros of Ridley Scott to put a female at the middle of this movie at the time that he made the movie, because women traditionally the main characters of horror films, right? But not in this way, not like in full empowerment mode in a sci-fi movie. It was unheard of at the time. And, really, even in years past, like they immediately passed the baton to like the Arnold Schwarzeneggers and the Sylvester Stallones of the world. It took a long time between the Alien movies and other sci-fi movies to catch up to the idea that women can be the main star of these and people will show up as long as it's a good movie. Really doesn't matter who's at the center of it. And I think he doesn't get enough credit for that. And I think Sigourney Weaver pulling it off, she doesn't get enough credit for that. I do think they do get credit for it, though, occasionally, just not enough. Like, this movie was entered into the Library of Congress for being culturally, historically, and aesthetically significant, and yet still, Zach put it as his number five. I can't explain it.
No, that's untrue. slander.
Was your
I put it as my number six.
Okay, sorry. Yeah. Number six. Not even top five. How dare you?
Top 10. Definitely solidly top 10.
Top 10.
Good, good.
In a field of like 25.
Atmospheric. Great. Great film.
What's your number two?
My number two, Blade Runner. It's got to be Blade Runner.
Mm-hmm.
Blade Runner is great. It's troubling, problematic with its sexual politics, watching it in 2023. But
with the robots and stuff, or the androids? Is that what you're talking about?
According to one interpretation. No, there's a scene with Deckard and the lady, mm-hmm. and he's very, very rapey in that scene.
Okay.
He forces a kiss on her.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, but apart from that, the movie is like,
but she's an android, right? Iconic.
So she has no rights.
Oh my gosh. This is what's it called all over again?
No,
the movie where the robot and
Ex Machina?
Ex Machina all over again.
I don't think
he's a robot too. So what?
Whoa,
what are we doing here?
Whoa. I don't think that Ridley Scott was trying to make a point of, oh, he sees her as a robot, has no rights, so he can do what he wants with her. I think Ridley Scott was just using a tired convention of a man wants a kiss from a woman, so he just takes it. And then the woman succumbs because she didn't realize that what she was missing out on until he laid it on
her. So that's the troublesome part. The fact that he gets away with it because it was such a good smackaroo.
It's a tiresome trope of,
sure,
you don't want a kiss, we'll give it to you anyway, but you'll fall in love with me after I kiss you.
Hmm.
But the set pieces,
the set pieces,
the score,
the matte paintings.
Yeah, the matte paintings. Oh, chef's kiss than the matte paintings. yeah, I mean, the movie's really good. So apart from that, nice. That's why it's my number two. Better than Blade Runner 2049.
Mm.
Well, my number one, and I believe this is also James's number one, Blade Runner.
No, he already had Blade Runner.
I already named Blade Runner.
Oh, you already named Blade Runner. Oh my goodness. I was looking for a picture. I wasn't paying attention. My apologies.
His number one is Exodus: Gods and Kings.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Prometheus. Yeah. No. Anyway. So yeah, this is Ridley Scott's masterpiece, right? It is, it's everything he is great at in this movie. Story-wise, this is another adaptation, right, of a Philip K. Dick book. This movie has gone through multiple iterations and cuts, and I'm going to say that the final cuts is, by the way, the one I'm putting as my number one. I have seen all three of them, and they all have varying ups and downs, but for sure, Final Cuts is the strongest of the three. It is a great performance from Harrison Ford as Deckard. And then, yeah, just the absolute world building in this movie. How many other movies have we pointed to that have been like, oh yeah, it's Blade Runner-esque? Like, that is a term within film terminology.
Mm-hmm.
The use of practical effects to give this lived-in world. I jokingly said matte paintings before, but this movie has beautiful matte paintings, and I love matte paintings. And there's just some incredible ones in this. I remember watching this with Megan a couple years ago, and I think I was annoying her because I kept pausing. I was like, Megan, check out this matte painting. And she was like, I get it, Kyle. I get it. And I think that kind of ruins the movie for her somewhat because I was just geeking out of it the entire time.
Sure.
But it's wonderful. It's a great movie. I think it's like my number 30 or 25 or something like that. So it's high up there.
Nice. My favorite Ridley Scott movie of all time is, of course, Gladiator from the year 2000.
Mm-hmm.
Pre-9/11 movie, which is how I mark time. Great film, Gladiator. Watched it on 4K today, and it was the extended director's cut. And to be honest, I don't know what they added. because I watched it and I was like, this all feels like it should be here. And
probably a lot more of him floating over fields of rye and grain.
Probably. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I this movie isn't based on a true story, right? It's like taking bits and pieces of stories and kind of mashing it into one big thing.
I mean, there was a Commodus who fought as a gladiator for fun.
Right. But the details of what is in Gladiator.
For sure.
I believe
I don't think Ridley Scott's strong suit is like historical accuracy.
I don't know. Napoleon was very accurate. Extremely accurate.
Was it, James?
Shh, Kyle. No spoilers. Gladiator. In recently watching on 4K for the first time, after having not seen it for probably 10 years easy, I was a little afraid that like some of the limited CG would show the seams, basically. And no, it looked great. The tigers looked great. The scale of him in the arena, which is a good deal CG, it all looked beautiful. Also, the movie itself plays beautifully. It's a good mix of like action scene, political scene, love scene, action scene. You know what I mean? It's like action scenes mixed with boring stuff. And it makes the boring stuff interesting because there's just enough action to keep things going. And I really love Gladiator, and I'm happy to put it at my number one slot on my favorite films of Ridley Scott list.
James, it's really interesting hearing your review of Gladiator after talking Napoleon with you.
Why?
I'll
say this without spoiling it for Zach. I like that Gladiator tells a specific continuous story from one end to the other with very little extraneous stuff. That's all I'll say about it.
Okay. Yeah, I don't want to get into it without ruining anything for Zach, but it's interesting to hear you talk Gladiator after you talk Napoleon.
Why? Do you think they're more similar than I'm saying?
No, I think you were looking for Napoleon to be another Gladiator.
Oh, I would love that. But I'm not mad at it.
I'm not mad at it for not
being that, but who wouldn't want Napoleon to be another Gladiator, right? That'd be awesome.
Okay.
They needed more tigers in Napoleon, that's for sure.
Yeah, I forgot that they kind of, that's one thing they left out, which I was disappointed by.
All the
tiger attacks.
Yep.
Famously.
Somehow they got the Sepultura song in there, though.
Is that Sepultura? It's Sepultura?
I don't know. Is it?
Sepulcher.
I always said Sepultura.
What did I say? Sepultura?
You said Sepultura.
Okay, yeah. I've never heard of this band. I have no idea what you're talking about. But if it's based on a biblical word, it's sepulcher.
No, it's Sepultura, something like that.
No, there's an R-A at the end.
It's not sepulcher. I know. This is Sepultura. Yeah.
Okay. Anyways.
Sepultura.
My number one is Gladiator.
Yeah.
Nice.
Okay. That's a bingo.
This movie's so awesome. I've seen this movie so many times. I've probably seen it 15 times. It's great.
When's the last time you saw it? Like, are you on a break from Gladiator?
I'm on a break. I want to rewatch it. I want to go to your house and borrow your 4K and watch it.
All right.
It looks awesome on 4K. I watched it on 4K in the last year, I want to say. And it looked great.
Yeah. Love this movie. It's definitely the role I think of when I think of Joaquin Phoenix, which made me not like him for a long time because he's absolutely despicable in this movie.
Sure.
It's really great. It's super good.
It's also the role I think of when I think of Russell Crowe. Like, it's the role of his lifetime, right? Basically, like nothing got any better than this.
Yeah, he peaked. Like, this also broke him out and peaked about the same time, correct?
I think so, possibly. Yeah.
Well, he was in that math one.
A Beautiful Mind.
Yeah.
But that came out a year later.
Yeah, and certainly he got, you know, accolades for that, but it's no Gladiator.
Right.
And The Insider.
Also a good movie, not The Gladiator.
Yeah, no, I mean, like, he's had other good roles. I'm not saying that he's not a one-hit wonder acting-wise.
You're saying he peaked.
He's never reached Gladiator Maximus proportions. Yes.
Yeah. You disagree, Zach? You think A Beautiful Mind or whatever else you mentioned is better than Gladiator?
The Insider.
No, The Insider.
I don't agree with
exactly.
That.
Exactly. Mean, you agree with us.
I liked him in Nice Guys. I thought like he nice worked guys. Well on Nice Guys.
You're right.
For sure. Yeah. I just think when I think of a peak, to say that he peaked and then never regained, in one sense, I agree with him in the sense of his best movie is Gladiator, his best performance, his most iconic performance. So that, I guess, is a peak. But when I think of a peak, I think of a precipitous decline. And if he still has like super well-regarded films extending on through the decades, then I think of it less as a peak as like a like his first big moment, at which he had other moments.
Yeah, but none I still being think it's also his first. Highest. You're right. I still it's his first big moment and his highest, biggest moment of the.
It's the peak. That's what a peak is. The highest.
I
mean, moment.
I get it. Are we talking about a mountain?
The
a
rest
mountain
of his career can do this as long as the highest are never higher than the first one. That's the peak.
I agree. It just it has a connotation of of a drop off.
We're not slagging him. We're just saying that was the peak.
It's peak Russell Crowe.
I know they're going to make a Gladiator 2. Ridley Scott's back at it. Do you think Russell Crowe will appear in Gladiator 2?
Well, if you look at his Letterboxd filmography, the answer is no. Mm.
I mean, but they could like make him one of the politicians or something. I mean, he's in no shape to be like in the arena anymore, but certainly there's
body shame much.
I'm not shaming him. I'm just saying there's certain requirements for the role and he probably doesn't fit those anymore. No shame in that game.
You think he fights a rather large gladiator in the movie.
Okay. So they're just going to put him out on the stage and he's going to get
Kyle, by large you mean like an incredibly
like muscular or
no
gladiator? Bulbous.
No, I mean I'm sure the guy's muscular, but he also has a nice layer of padding on top of all of it.
Subcutaneous.
It's the guy with the bull hat, with the bull helmet that's wearing it.
Well, Russell Crowe is on record of being jealous of Gladiator 2, and he's not in it.
Oh, he's not in it. Ooh,
he's not in it.
Unfortunate.
He should be in it. They should sneak him in, Alfred Hitchcock style. Just have him walk by the screen. And
he should sneak
wink
himself
at the audience.
In.
Yeah.
Potentially Denzel's in it.
Denzel's in it?
Potentially.
Isle of Dr. Moreau style. That got me. That was a good one. All right. That was our top 10 Ridley Scott movies. Do you agree? Do you disagree? The best way to let us know is by sending us an email, heyguys@cinerealist.com. You could also find us on YouTube. Search Cinerealist on YouTube. Watch while you listen. Support us on Patreon. Get extra after show audio. Leave us an Apple Podcast. We'd appreciate that. That's free and it will only take a moment and will help others find the podcast. You could also follow us on social media, on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, or TikTok at Cinerealist, or you could follow me on my personal Twitter or Letterboxd account at YoJRB.
And you can follow me on Twitter or Letterboxd at Shobin.
You can find me on Letterboxd at PeterSKB.
Next week, we will be talking the new Emerald Fennell film, Saltburn. Emerald Fennell.
Fennell. I don't know if James knows how to pronounce words.
Fennell, F-E-N-N-E-L-L.
Have you listened to the show?
No, but like fennel is a vegetable, a sprig of some sort.
Is it?
Twiddle Elijah Four.
I twiddled myself. All right.
You twiddled yourself.
Just for you. Okay. Just for you, Kyle.
So, American Gangster, Twiddle Ejiofor is in that movie. Uh-huh. And I don't even know how to say his name anymore. I've just heard Twiddle so many times. I see his name. I have to remind myself, which one is it actually?
Sure.
You got twiddled. Exactly. Yeah. I've twiddled myself.
Oh, so great.
All right. So yeah, looking forward to Saltburn starring Barry Keoghan, Rosamund Pike, and Carey Mulligan. It's going to be a good one. Can't wait to talk to you guys about that movie. We still need to come up with a list. Not sure what we're going to talk about as far as the list goes, but we'll figure it out. If you have a suggestion, email us. Either way, we'll see you there. Until then, keep it cine-real.
You're still here? It's over. Go home. Go.